Grade 12 Quaker Education Program, helping students develop spiritually as well as academically. A list of recent student stories, such as one from Lauren Raddick, who designed a dress that captured the movement of water, are available at mfriends.org. That's mfriends.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
Think Pennsylvania's government is on the right track or going off the rails? Now's the chance to have your voice heard. This is Ask Governor Wolf, a live statewide show by Keystone Crossroads. I'm Kevin McCrory, and we'll spend this hour with Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, talking about the state's most pressing issues.
We must update our flawed and outdated charter law for the benefit of every student and every taxpayer in the Commonwealth.
From education to guns,
we need to fix our weak gun laws and pass reforms focused on increasing safety.
The economy to legal weed.
My impression is that the Pennsylvanians are ready for this.
No topic is off the table. We'll have Keystone Crossroads reporters Laura Benshoff and Avi Wolfman-Aaron here with us to help break it all down. And we want to hear from you. Call us at 1-888-477-9499 or hit us up on Twitter using the hashtag AskGovWolf. All this and more after NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Donald Trump is now urging a second foreign government to investigate his political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, ahead of the 2020 presidential election.
China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
To that, Biden said in a statement today that Trump was, quote, flailing and melting down on national TV. Biden's dialing up his verbal attack on Trump a day after laying into the president over his defense of his conversation this summer with the leader of Ukraine, his disparagement of the whistleblower who filed the complaint about that call, and the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry in the U.S. House. NPR's Scott Detrow has more.
For most of the past week, Biden's approach was to largely ignore Trump's constant and unproven charges of corruption. Speaking at a campaign event in Reno, Biden said Trump's main charge, that Biden pressured Ukraine to fire a prosecutor in order to protect his son Hunter, is a lie. Biden says his pressure was an effort to clean up corruption in Ukraine.
It was a fully transparent policy carried out in front of the whole world and fully embraced by the international community of democracies.
Biden says he expects Trump's attacks to continue, but said in the Nevada speech, quote, I'm not going anywhere. Scott Detrow, NPR News, Washington.
Today, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, tweeted, the president cannot use the power of his office to pressure foreign leaders to investigate his political opponents. Trump, of course, denies that he pressured anyone into investigating the Bidens. Other House Democrats also criticize the president today. Opponents of a new Trump administration rule that makes it more difficult for immigrants to get green cards if they use public benefits are asking a federal judge to delay the rule. Here's NPR's Pam Fessler.
The so-called public charge rule is set to go into effect October 15th. Opponents say it will hurt millions of immigrant families who are in the U.S. legally, but will likely drop out of programs such as Medicaid and food stamps for fear that it will hurt their legal status. A group of 14 states challenging the rule will argue in U.S. District Court in Washington State today that the change will harm their residents, including many who are U.S. citizens. It's one of several lawsuits that have been filed challenging the rule. The Trump administration says that it's only trying to clarify existing law to ensure that green card holders do not become dependent on government aid. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 52 points at 26,131. You're listening to NPR News.
This is WHYY News in Philadelphia at 104. Good afternoon. I'm Kenneth Burns. The Pennsylvania House of Representatives will resume opening sessions with faith-based prayers. Republican House Speaker Mike Terzai announced those plans after a federal district court judge ended an injunction. The Third Circuit Federal Appeals Court ruled 2-1 in August that a prohibition against atheists and other non-believers giving the opening invocation did not violate the Constitution's Establishment Clause. The House returns to Harrisburg on the 21st. Terzai's office says he has not selected the person who will give the invocation that day. Delaware Treasurer Colleen Davis has apologized for improper use of her state-owned vehicle. That also includes taking it home without permission. Davis said in a statement she would never intentionally use state-owned property in a way that is inconsistent with state fleet vehicle policy. She says she has filled out the proper forms to use the vehicle outside business hours. New Jersey's Teacher of the Year is from a South Jersey school district. Kimberly Dickstein was bestowed the honor yesterday. She teaches English at Haddonfield Memorial High School, where she got married last week in a school courtyard. The Rutgers grad has taught in the school district for 11 years. She serves as an advisor to the high school's Model United Nations, Stand with Camden Group, and the Shakespeare Troupe. The award includes a new car, a clothing allowance, and a trip to D.C. to meet the president, along with other state teachers of the year. Cloudy with showers likely for the rest of the afternoon. Temperatures in the lower 60s. It's 106.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Constant Contact, with email marketing automation tools designed for small businesses to send the right email at the right time. Their suite of tools now also includes a website builder. More at ConstantContact.com.
This is Ask Governor Wolf. I'm Kevin McCrory, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Governor Tom Wolf, thank you for joining us on this statewide broadcast from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Thank you, Kevin. It's good to be here.
Also joining us in studio today is Keystone Crossroads reporter Laura Benshoff.
Hi there.
She covers changing communities in the state, and Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Hello.
Our K-12 education reporter. We'll also be monitoring your questions on Twitter, following along to the AskGovWolf hashtag. We also want to hear you on the phones. Our first segment will be about gun legislation and the prospect of legal weed. Please call with your questions for the governor on those topics at 1-888-477-9499. So, Governor Wolf, I know you had a busy morning. You signed an executive order on climate change. We're going to get to that a little bit later in the show. But first, I want to get to something else you've recently made news about. When we talked in June, I asked you about the prospect of legalizing marijuana in Pennsylvania. You were not ready to commit. This is what you said.
There are a lot of things that I think we have to learn, and I think there's no premium or there's no benefit to actually rushing into this. We want to do it right. Okay. If we do it, we want to do it right.
So last week you announced you are for it. What changed?
Well, Lieutenant Governor's 67-county tour went out and was asked to do it. You're right. I wasn't sure Pennsylvania was ready for it. In fact, I didn't think Pennsylvania was. And he went out, and in all the counties, the response was overwhelming. We also had people weigh in through the website, emails, faxes, phone calls, and again, the response was very positive. Now, no one made any claims that this was a scientific sample.
Right.
We were just trying to, and the lieutenant governor just wanted to get the pulse of Pennsylvania, and it was so overwhelming that I was convinced that we ought to move forward with it. Now, in Pennsylvania, the Constitution does not allow us to have a referendum and
right.
say, okay, let's test this proposition. The General Assembly has to represent the will of the people, and so that's where it lies now.
And you've been criticized by some people in the legislature, Republicans mainly, for the forums maybe being oversampled with people who already support the idea. So how much credence can we put into what we heard at these forums?
I think you can put a lot. I mean, the idea of the listening tour was to actually get people's ideas and their thoughts on what we ought to do, how we ought to do it, whether we're ready for it. I think if you actually want to poll people's and see where does Pennsylvania stand, look at opinion polls, which basically say that Pennsylvania is ready for it. So, again, the General Assembly has the responsibility to take the wishes of the people and turn them into public policies. One of the things the report of the lieutenant governor had included was the experiences of other states. So how do they regulate it? How do they tax it? What are the things they've learned from what yeah. they've done? What can we learn? And I think if we do that, and the General Assembly does that, we could come up with some good policy.
Because you talked about in that clip we played, doing it right. What does it mean to you to do it right? Do you have a concrete idea of that at this point?
I'm open to how to do it, but again, I think we've seen some things. For example, there are states out there that have overtaxed it, so has not really allowed it to come. Has actually improved the underground economy. We don't want to do that. We want to bring this out into the light, and so you want to make sure that we're addressing the issue of criminal rents. We want to make sure that we are allowing. And again, this is adult regulated. Use of recreational cannabis.
Right. We did hear a lot of comments on this across the state. We heard from Sylvina Godoy. She wrote to us, legalize marijuana, expunge nonviolent records. It's time to catch up with the civilized world. If this moves forward, what do you do about the people who've been penalized or jailed over the years for marijuana offenses?
Well, there are three things that the lieutenant governor and I recommended. The one that got the most play, obviously, was calling for legalization. But the other two things that can be done even more quickly, and that is to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. I ran on that back in 2014 and again in 2018, and I still believe that's important. We have people we are paying over $40,000 a year to incarcerate for years because they possessed a small amount of marijuana, and that will be a life sentence for them because for the rest of their lives they will have a tough time getting jobs, tough time getting apartments, tough time getting into higher education, all those things.
So do you have to do something more than expunge the record?
Well, I want to decriminalize first and then expunge their records so that they don't have that. When an employer does a background check, this doesn't show up. So those are two things we can do. Now, in the meantime, the lieutenant governor and I also had another press conference where we said, you know, there is the pardons process. Let's make sure that we're using that to the fullest extent because this is something that we all recognize the person should not be given a life sentence for a minor infraction of the law, and so I want to we can use that right now, but we'd also like to proceed with decriminalization and expungement.
As you've been noting, of course, you're going to need the legislature's buy-in on this. Alex Bredekin, grad student from Philadelphia, asked pretty much that exact question. How do you get buy-in from Republican lawmakers? Laura, you've been tracking some of the mm-hmm. things that we've been seeing from lawmakers in the state. Where's that conversation at?
So, for example, House Speaker Mike Terzi just yesterday tweeted out several links to articles and studies that deal with a potential link between marijuana use and increased risk of psychosis, so some health risks, particularly for young people. There were also articles around whether or not legalization actually has a downward pressure on drug crimes. They sort of cherry-picked the example of the Northern Triangle in California, this area where marijuana has been grown for decades in an illicit manner, and said actually growing it legally made people who grew it, you know, themselves targets of crime. So I'm wondering how you would respond to those lines of argument that you will probably have to overcome, you know, if you're going to convince your colleagues to pass legislation around this.
Yeah, I think prohibition didn't work with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work with the numbers games. We now have a lottery. We need to bring this out into the open. The opioid epidemic, we've started to make progress in Pennsylvania precisely because we brought it out into the open, because we have actually made it something that we can talk about. And I think all the legalization process would be bring something that's now under the table being done on a street corner somewhere, bring it out into the open, and let's deal with it as the issue that it is.
Well, you brought up the opioid crisis. I'm seeing a caller, Genevieve in Philadelphia, is asking about the opioid crisis. Do we have that call ready?
Yep. Hi.
Hey, Genevieve, what's your question for the governor? Please keep it concise.
I wanted to know, I'm actually calling specifically from Kensington, and like if you Google Kensington and you want to know where the best place in America to buy heroin is, it's Kensington. We have been inundated for 2.5 years with a clean out that the city did. And the Kenney administration keeps saying, oh, we have this plan, and oh, we have that plan. And none of the plans seem to be taking effect. Our neighborhood is, we're dealing with needles everywhere.
So
we're
Genevieve, let's take this to the governor. Governor Wolf, this is a problem not only in Kensington. We're talking about in counties across the state. And what is your administration doing to solve it? And is it happening fast enough?
Yeah, Genevieve, that's a great question. I'm trying to do things, and I think in Harrisburg I've gotten broad support for trying to make sure that we get to a point where people are not injecting anything into their bodies. And that's what we ultimately have to do to solve the issues that you're facing and that you're talking about in Kensington. But again, the first step is to bring this out, to start talking about, to actually embrace this as a challenge that we all face and that we've got to do something about. And it starts with the idea that we don't deny that this is going on.
All right, let's transition here. The legislature has been back in session for a few weeks now. A lot of debate on bills about gun control and gun rights. Let's take stock of the moment we're in for a second here. Gun violence in Philadelphia has been rising. Last month, you had 6 city police officers wounded in a standoff with a suspect with a long criminal record that should have barred him from legally owning a gun. We're also about a year removed from the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history, Pennsylvania's worst mass shooting in at least decades, when a gunman who authorities say expressed anti-Semitic hatred killed 11 people at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue. In general, the people of Pennsylvania seem to remain divided on how to proceed. Here's 2 perspectives we heard. First, Andre Horn, a boxing coach from Southwest Philadelphia.
You see the news every day like everybody else. It's too much. What are you doing about this killing?
And second, let's hear from Chris, a 59-year-old from Quakertown.
I think the responsible gun owners will do well with their guns, as usual. It's the people, the bad people, that are always going to have the guns, no matter what. So you leave pretty much us defenseless to protect ourselves and our family.
Governor Wolf, we've seen this debate play out nationally for decades. What do you see as the road forward?
I think the road forward is we've got to stop yelling at each other, and we have to recognize that we have a problem. We have a Second Amendment. I get that. We also have the right to feel comfortable going to a mall, to a Walmart, to school, to my job, and not be concerned that I'm going to be shot. So we have to sit down and reconcile those two issues. There are entirely too many people dying because of gun violence. And you mentioned a few of those statistics that are really troubling. We need to sit down and we can deny that we have a problem again, but we have to figure out, we got to get out of denial and start to address the issue. And that's all I'm talking about. And I think the majority of Pennsylvanians actually want to do something.
And if there was a specific thing you would offer forward for, I think that this can stop the bad gun violence that we all agree is bad, but also retain the rights of folks who are using guns for lawful reasons?
Sure. I don't think there's one thing that can do this, but here's a couple things that I think we ought to do. We ought to have universal background checks. We ought to address the gun show loophole in Pennsylvania. We ought to ban assault weapons. We have already taken guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. We ought to have passed the red flag law that says that people can make sure that loved ones who have guns and are have some problems don't possess those guns. Those are things we can do right now.
Laura, you've been tracking how that bill specifically has been going through the legislature. What are you seeing?
That's right. Earlier this year, you set a red flag law, a law that would allow a judge to take away a gun from someone who is believed to be, you know, in immediate risk of harming themselves or someone else. This has not moved in Harrisburg. House Judiciary Committee Chair Robert Kaufman said earlier this year he won't consider it, even though it has some bipartisan support, because it's not fair to gun owners. And what's your response to that?
Yeah, I think that's Representative Kaufman's comments surprised a lot of us, because I actually thought there was, and I think there is, reasonable bipartisan support for doing something. Now, again, in a legislature, there are people in key positions who can block the will of the majority, and I think that might be what's happening here. I think Senate Republicans and Democrats are in favor of this. I think House Republicans and House Democrats are in favor of moving forward with a reasonable red flag law. But the reality of Democratic, with a small d, politics is that there are people in key positions who can actually block things.
Right, but that committee did pass some bills outright. They passed a bill to increase mandatory sentencing for people who commit a violent or drug crime with a firearm. There's also a bill to shorten the time someone who is involuntarily committed has to turn over their firearms. I mean, are these the type of bills you would sign if they come across your desk?
No.
Why not?
Why not?
First of all, they don't work, and I think that they actually one of the most interesting conversions was a state senator who is now retired, but who was one of the authors of mandatory sentencing bills in the 90s, and almost tearfully said in his last year in the Senate that I have learned that they don't work, they're wrong, that they violate the civil rights of too many people, and they also run afoul of discretion that judges ought to have.
All right, we're coming up on a short break. You can hear the music there, Governor. We're going to continue to discuss a lot of these important issues of Pennsylvania, especially we're going to get into public education next. Call with your questions at 1-888-477-9499 or hit us up on that Twitter using the hashtag AskGovWolf. Keep listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, and Virtua. The Penn Medicine Virtua Cancer Program offers a full range of treatment options for cancer patients right here in South Jersey, including reconstructive programs for breast cancer, minimally invasive surgery and advanced radiation treatments for colon and lung cancer, and dedicated nurse navigation to guide patients through their complex cancer journey. More details are available at virtua.org/penncancer. And Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey. Now in its 21st year, the annual Festival of Fine Craft takes place rain or shine on October 5th and 6th. The festival features the work of 150 juried artists, craft demonstrations, hands-on family art activities, a beer and wine garden, hourly door prizes, and the crowd favorite Wheaton Arts Glass Pumpkin Patch. More Festival of Fine Craft details at wheatonarts.org. That's wheatonarts.org.
And welcome back to Ask Governor Wolf. I'm Kevin McCrory, joined in studio by Governor Tom Wolf, as well as Keystone Crossroads reporters Laura Benshoff and Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The phone lines are open. We want to hear your questions. We're going to start now with public education. Reach us at 1-888-477-9499 or on Twitter using that hashtag AskGovWolf. So classes have been in session for about a month now. For me personally, this was a first. I have a five-year-old son who started kindergarten at a school in Northwest Philadelphia. So I want to ask you about school infrastructure. As a parent, my baseline is a safe, clean, healthy school. But there are a lot of school buildings in this state, particularly in urban districts, that have aging facilities that do not seem to meet this baseline. We're talking about issues with lead paint, asbestos, problems with HVAC. So what do you say to parents like me, students and teachers, who have to worry about these conditions?
Yeah, you shouldn't have to worry about those conditions. I mean, those are excellent baseline concerns. Last year, the state put almost $7 million, contributed to the city school district of Philadelphia for lead abatement. This year, another multi-million dollar grant. But it's not enough. We need to do more, which is, again, I'm selling here my Restore Pennsylvania, which would be billions of dollars, part of which could be used for remediation of lead, mold, asbestos.
This is your plan, to be clear, to institute a shale tax and use the proceeds from that to fund all sorts of projects across the state,
actually,
including school buildings.
To monetize it, so take the present value of that future stream for 20 years, and that would be about $4 to $5 billion, yes, and use that to do things that would help a number of areas, but one of them is addressing the problem of lead paint, asbestos, mold in classrooms. We also have to make sure that every child in Philadelphia and every school district gets a good education. We need to make sure that they're coming to school to safe places. We need to make sure they're also getting a good education. That means we've got to make sure we're investing adequately in our schools. Since I've been governor, I have got in a bipartisan way $1.2 billion of additional funding, and that's
before we move away from school infrastructure. I mean, this problem is it's immediate. Like, there's high schools right now that are closed this week because of asbestos issues.
Yes,
and there are other issues across the state that are happening on a daily basis. So I know that, you know, your Restore PA plan is hinged on this Marcellus tail tax, but we've been talking about that for like a decade at this point, right? So like, what is the immediate fix?
Yeah, I presented my Restore Pennsylvania.
Right, but the proceeds would come from the shale tax, and we've been talking about the shale tax for a decade, and it hasn't happened.
That's the effort is to say, okay, here I think maybe one of my concern was that one of the questions was, would this just be money that go into the general fund? And so in January, I said, let's do a Restore Pennsylvania, and let's make sure this goes directly. It's separate from the budget, separate from the general fund. It goes into projects and things that are needed at the local level. And the hope is that people say, okay, for that use, this actually makes sense. We're the only state without a shale tax in the country. It's time that we do this so that we can, I mean, we're all paying it. We're paying it to other states. Let's make sure that we have a shale tax that we can actually fund the things that are important to us at the local level, like school infrastructure.
And you mentioned that you've been fighting for more school resources in general. Mm-hmm. The truth is that has occurred, but it's also the truth that those increases necessarily haven't gone to help classrooms because there's been the rising fixed costs, such as pension obligations, healthcare obligations. So you still do have stress in school districts, despite the legislative work that you and others have done on that subject. I want to bring into the conversation Carly Harris. She's somebody we met who wanted to talk about this. She's a new mom in Philadelphia. In theory, she would like to send her child to a public school.
So my local school, I know that they recently had to pick between a Spanish teacher or an art teacher. And I feel like that's a really tough pill for parents to swallow. And in wanting to support our local schools, I really don't like to hear things like that.
So your response to her in context of the fact that, of course, local school districts have to be responsible with the money that they spend at the same time.
That's true. On the other hand, she is absolutely right. They shouldn't have to make that kind of choice. We need to make sure that every child gets a great education, and the schools ought to be able to have the wherewithal to be able to afford a Spanish teacher and an art teacher. So that I think she's absolutely right. And we need to do what we can at the state level to help make sure schools all over the state have the resources they need so that we don't have to face those bad choices.
Let's bring Avi Wolfman-Aaron to the conversation. He's our K-12 education reporter.
Yeah, going off of the funding issue, part of it is not just the total resources, but how the resources are distributed. You introduced a formula, or you signed a formula that starts to even out some of these historic imbalances. Zachary Wright on Twitter asks, what can be done to address PA's inequitable funding formulas that see students in the West Philadelphia zip code be apportioned $14,000 by the state for their education, while those in Lower Merion receive $28,000 per pupil? Just to build off that question, there are still some inequities, some serious inequities that exist among districts. There's a lawsuit about it. Do you support changing the amount of money that runs through that new fair funding formula so that some of these inequities are balanced out a little quicker?
Yeah, I'd like to get to a full funding, fair funding formula as quickly as we can. Now, recognize the practical obstacles to doing that. I don't want to do that at the expense of the school kids in some other part of the state. So it makes it tough. 100% of all new funding has gone out according to the fair funding formula. But as you point out, that still makes the money going out according to a fair funding formula a drop in the bucket. It's like close to 10%, not enough. And at the rate we're increasing that percentage, it's just not fast enough to address the issues of people here and now. So I get the frustration. I have not figured out how to get to that 100% formula as quickly as in a very fast way, but I recognize the importance of doing that.
Let's stay on education for just a moment, but switch to charter schools. You made some announcements over the summer. We got a deluge of questions from people who support school choice who feel like you're attacking them. One of them is Stephanie D'Amico from Delaware County. She sends all three of her kids to a cyber charter school.
It takes away our voice and our choice as a parent. You know, there are some children that thrive in brick and mortar, but then there's some children that don't. And I think that, you know, we should have a choice or a say in what happens with our children.
So what are you trying to do legislatively, and what do you say to someone like Stephanie?
Well, first of all, Stephanie, I believe that choice ought to exist. I think there's some great charter schools out there, including some great cyber charter schools. What I'm trying to do is bring accountability to the taxpayer. These are all taxpayer-funded programs. And so, as they exist, they ought to be make sure that the taxpayers have some connection with what's going on. I think we ought to make sure that her kids and everybody in any school in Pennsylvania, that we're doing everything we can to assure that there is quality in the education. And then we ought to level the playing field. We mandate transparency and openness for traditional public schools. We need to do the same thing for private charter schools to make sure that they are doing the things that we expect any taxpayer-supported program to do. This is not taking choice away. It's introducing accountability to the system that exists right now, and I think that's a fair thing.
Avi, you've been covering this issue closely. Tell us about it.
Well, one proposal that's out there that was introduced actually by a Republican, Kurt Sonny, who's the head of the House Education Committee, has an idea that if a school district offered its own virtual program, right? You're nodding because you know this proposal. If a parent living in that district wanted to go to a cyber charter school, they would have to pay their own tuition. And if they wanted a free virtual option, they'd have to go to the in-house district option. Do you support that idea? Do you think that's a fair way to even out the playing field here?
Yeah, he and I have talked about this, and I think he has some really interesting points there. The idea is that I think most of the intermediate units or school districts, one way or another, have a public cyber option.
Yep.
In many cases, these options, I think in all cases, are actually cheaper than the taxpayers are paying for the private cyber charter option. Even in some cases where the private cyber charter school is using exactly the same software as the public cyber charter school or cyber school, cyber program uses. He's, I think, expressing the frustration of a lot of school districts that they're sending taxpayer dollars that could be used in those public schools unaccounted for to these other places when they have the ability to do it at a lot lower price. So what Representative Chairman Sonny is talking about, I think, is really interesting, and I think deserves some merit. I think he has actually retreated from that recently, so it'd be interesting to see where he is now.
Where are you now? I mean, what do you think is the best way to balance the competing interests of traditional school districts that have their own virtual programs with the parents who have chosen cyber charter schools?
I think that choice is really important. We actually have choice in our public school system. And the charter school programs that started 22 years ago actually augment that. But we've had this kind of magnet schools, Votex. We've basically had specialty schools that have been taxpayer funded for a long time. I'm just trying to create, again, that accountability, the quality control, and the level playing field in terms of the regulations that we expect all of the participants in taxpayer funded education.
Do you make a distinction between public schools and charter schools?
No.
It sounded like you did in what you had just said.
Well, I call them traditional public schools. Okay. I was just trying to say that what we know is traditional public schools, but that's different in every school district. So I'm just trying to form a distinction. Again, there are some really phenomenal charter schools, and the whole idea behind the charter school approach was that we could learn a whole lot of things to what we ought to be able to do in the traditional public school space from the innovations that come from the charter school system, and it broadens the array of choices that parents have and students have. We just got to make sure we're doing it right.
Okay, let's transition to talk about energy and the environment. A few weeks ago, students across the Commonwealth, nation, and world rallied for a more aggressive response to climate change. For this show, we also heard from many young people on the topic. Rachel Suchman is a junior at Penn State.
What are your plans to continue to combat climate change in Pennsylvania?
You made news earlier today when you signed an executive order saying Pennsylvania will take steps to join a coalition of Northeast states that require fossil fuel burning energy plants to pay for the carbon that they emit. Tell us more about it and how you think it answers Rachel's question.
Yeah, I think the answer to Rachel's question is not this. It's a whole host of things. And I think what Rachel, and I think most Pennsylvanians are talking about is that we need to just stop talking about it or arguing about it, but start moving forward on things that actually address the challenges we face with climate change. And I've tried to do that with setting targets and goals, which I did last year by joining the Climate Alliance, which basically ties us to the Paris Accord, which the Trump administration took the country out of. But I basically am making sure Pennsylvania is part of that. And what I did today was say, okay, targets and goals are fine. Let's also include action. This is one thing that we can do, which is to address the issue of fossil fuel burning power plants. There's still more that we have to do. We have to look at this as the urgent problem that it is.
And as I understand the thing that you did this morning, so now if I'm a fossil fuel burning plant, I now have to pay for the carbon that I emit into the air, and that money goes into the state's general fund.
You have a couple of choices. You can actually reduce your carbon emissions, and you can figure out technologies to do that, in which case you would pay less. Or you can pay into this. It's a market-based approach. It's a cap and trade. And it's something that we actually have some of the folks in the power industry already paying. The nuclear industry pays this right now. This is creating a level playing field and saying this is an externality that the market does not price into the product, but we as a society, recognizing that climate change is a big problem for us, that we've got to address it, we're going to price it in.
And the pushback here, though, is if you're a small Pennsylvania town or community that relies on coal and coal jobs, this could be devastating for you.
We need to do this in a way that is sensitive to the needs of communities and workers. But ultimately, we also have to recognize that every community, every worker, suffers if we don't do something about the changes that are going to really affect our lives. We might all die if we don't do this right.
You think it's that dire? How fast?
Sure it is. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. But I think the problem is real, and we have got to address that as understanding that each of us has specific interests in our day-to-day lives, but all of us have an overriding interest in the survival of the planet.
The proceeds from this could be anywhere from $500 million, $600 million. That's what I've seen reported from the Reggie. No?
I think it's less than
that.
Yeah.
Okay. Where would you potentially, how would you use those proceeds?
Well, I got that question today. It's a great question. I think that's one of the things that I would like to work with the General Assembly on figuring out where we spend this. The authorization for my doing this came from the Clean Air Act, which says it has to go toward something that addresses air quality.
So you wouldn't use it for Restore PA?
I don't think so. I don't want to make this my issue or my decision. I don't want this to be a political football. This is something that affects every. This is like World War II. You know, this whole country is in an effort to make our future safe for our children, our grandchildren. And this is something that does not deserve petty partisan politics. We've got to all work together. And so I am trying to be as open and positive as I can and say, okay, let's all sit down together and figure this out. This is a problem that affects all of us.
Even with everything we're talking about, you have been criticized by some on the left for not acting with enough urgency. I heard from a lot of people in the comments we've reached out through the state that said this. Lisa DeSantis in Lawrence County, why have you supported fracking our future? There's this feeling that you want a natural gas tax. That means you're tying us to a world of natural gas. I heard from a lot of people in Beaver County, including Joanne Martin, Linda Wichman, Peter Deutsch, who criticize your support for the ethane cracker plant that's being built there. Estimates on that one specifically say it could emit the equivalent of 500,000 cars a year in CO2. How does that fit into the goals that you're laying out here?
Yeah, I want to do, we do have this natural resource beneath our feet, and we need to do it right, and I want to do it right. But things like that cracker plant and products that will come out of the feedstock from that cracker plant are exactly the lightweight products that we're going to need in that energy efficient, sustainable energy future that we're moving toward. And so we need to do this right. That's why I have been focused on making sure we have in our traditional conventional drilling that we have strict regulations. We're going through the process. There's different hearings and public comment periods into air quality for methane. We've got to do all this right, but we've got to do it.
Let's take a quick call if we can. Elizabeth is ready on line 6, I believe, to talk about the environment. Elizabeth, are you there?
Yes,
keep
I'm
your
here.
Question very brief, if you can.
My question to Governor Wolf is about fracking. Once again, it not only uses and poisons inordinate amounts of fresh water, its byproduct is water full of dangerous chemicals, which are kept underground if possible, or are housed all
okay.
over the
Thank
state.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We are coming right up on a break. I want to give the governor a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, Elizabeth's concerns are absolutely correct. We need to make sure we do this right. And I will, Elizabeth, promise you that I will do this right and make sure that we are, as the fracking takes place in the western part of the state, it will be done right.
Okay, you can hear the music there. We're coming up on a short break. We're going to discuss a little bit more in the environment when we come back, but also how are average Pennsylvanians making ends meet? Call with your questions on those topics, 1-888-477-9499. Again, we're following the hashtag on Twitter, Ask Governor Wolf. We want to hear more from you there. Thanks so much for listening. Keep listening.
Supporting WHYY, Mount Cuba Center, a beautiful botanical garden in Hockessin, Delaware, invites listeners to go behind the scenes and experience Mount Cuba's wilder side. On Friday, October 5th and 12th, visitors can enjoy hayrides and hike through Mount Cuba's natural lands in their full autumn glory. Visitors can also explore these beautiful natural lands guided by knowledgeable docents. More information at mountcubacenter.org/WHYY. That's mtcubacenter.org/WHYY. And Cabrini University. Located in Radnor, PA, Cabrini University's Bachelor's of Science in Nursing offers students a curriculum focused on health equity, paired with Cabrini's Education of the Heart mission, dedicated to academic excellence, leadership, and social advocacy. Now accepting applications for fall 2020, Cabrini's nursing program equips students with the tools and resources to holistically care for every patient. Learn more at cabrini.edu/nursing.
And you're listening to Ask Governor Wolf. I'm Kevin McCrory, joined in studio by Governor Tom Wolf, as well as Keystone Crossroads reporters Laura Benshoff and Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Phone lines are open. We want to hear your questions. In this segment, we're going to talk about how average Pennsylvanians are making ends meet. Reach us at 1-888-477-9499 or on Twitter using the hashtag AskGovWolf. Before we get into that, though, let's stay on the environment, because I've really heard so much feedback from people in Western Pennsylvania about this. We got a question from Rick Mercer in Western PA asking how state government is supporting research into local fracking and the emergence of rare childhood cancers. Now, one of our reporters on the state impact team noted to me that you declined an invitation to Washington County to discuss the Department of Health's investigation into childhood cancer there. Thoughts on that, Governor?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that, I think we what we need to do is make sure that we are absolutely doing this with the right regulations to make sure that we're not endangering the health of anyone, and where we have good indications that we are the industry or somebody is endangering health, we ought to make sure that we're addressing those issues.
And one comment I've seen is that the Department of Energy is not, or Environmental Protection is not really fully staffed or fully funded to the point that some environmentalists would like to see it. Is that fair?
I think you could say that about any department. Before I got here, there were a number of departments that the number of employees were depleted. I specifically have been asking for more employees in a number of departments, including the Department of Environmental Protection. So we need more people. I just heard that yesterday from the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. We need more people, and so I think is a legitimate concern.
Okay, so the economy. Both nationally and in Pennsylvania, unemployment rates are very low. At the same time, recent United Way report found that roughly 1 in 3 Pennsylvania households struggle to afford life's basic necessities. In most cases, these are households where people are working and are above the poverty line, but barely getting by. What do you think the role of state government is in better ensuring that workers are prepared for and finding life-sustaining jobs?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing is that I'm meeting with, and I have met with folks from the United Way on that specific report to try to figure out what we could do to make sure that we're doing the things we ought to be doing. But I think in general, investment in education, investment in infrastructure, investment in the regulations to make sure that whatever we're doing is as safe as it can possibly be for the health of Pennsylvanians and for the environment. We need to make sure that we have fairness and safety in the workplace. I think I brought up the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. We have some investments that we should be making there. These are things that I think help make life better for everybody, whether they address the specific issues that are facing Pennsylvanian families struggling and that have been identified by the United Way report. I remains to be seen, but again, I will continue to work with them and meet with them to try to figure out what more we can do.
Now, top Republicans will say the best investment we can make into rising the boats for all is in jobs, and that, you know, they have plans, and this rubs up against the conversation we were just having about the environment, to basically replicate some of the ethane cracker type facilities that are happening in Beaver County, but making them happen more easily to happen across the state. And that in theory would create more good paying jobs. And that in theory would help those numbers that were in the United Way report go down. Have you read closely to the House Republicans' plan, Energize PA?
Yes.
And what's your thoughts on it?
I don't agree with it. And I have a jobs command center, actually a workforce preparation readiness command center that is headed up by members of the administration, cabinet secretaries, but also the head of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and the head of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. The chamber president and the AFL-CIO president both made a presentation to my cabinet meeting on Monday where they talked about the things and they didn't mention the Energize plan. They mentioned things like education. They mentioned things like transportation. They even mentioned things like food, clothing, that you need to make sure that the people are going to job interviews prepared. Those are the kinds of things that we need to do. We're talking about jobs out there that are looking for good employees. How can we make sure that those employees are ready to take those jobs?
And how does minimum wage and that battle fall into this?
Well, I think minimum wage is really important in that battle. Pennsylvania has a minimum wage now that's the lowest in our region, $7.25. It's the same as the federal government. And I proposed in, I think, every budget, but this last one to take it to 15. So far, have not been able to bring that across the finish line. Hopeful that there might be some movement this fall in the session we're in right now. But I'll continue to push for that because I think that is really an important issue.
And Laura, you've been tracking this.
Right. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of gaming out of what are the pros and cons of raising the minimum wage. There was an independent fiscal office report that showed it could add $50 million in tax revenues. But on the other side, that same report noted that 34,000 jobs could be lost as a result of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Is there another number that you think you could actually get through that would help alleviate some of the financial stress Pennsylvania families are under?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to take issue with the independent mm-hmm. fiscal office report. The gold standard, I think, in economics is a report that was done in the early 90s by two Princeton economists, Card and Kruger.
You're over our head now, Governor.
Yeah, bring it down to earth.
That looked at Pennsylvania and New Jersey. New Jersey had raised its minimum wage. Pennsylvania had not. So you had it cross Delaware River, actually clinical case in terms of what effect does this have? Theoretically, in a frictionless economic model, you'd have a substitution of labor for capital. But what actually happened, they found, was that the fast food chains on the New Jersey side of the border actually increased employment. That actually people working for them could now afford to buy their products and pay for the benefits, and that it They were expecting the sort of classical economic effect that the independent fiscal office talked about, which was a reduction in jobs. There was actually a mild increase in jobs on the New Jersey side of the border. So I think you have to take what independent fiscal office said with a grain of salt. But even if you take what they say, 34,000 jobs lost versus, let's say, moving to $12 an hour from $7.25, let's say a dollar average increase, because not everybody's at $7.25. There's some, but about a million or so people who would actually have their wages increase. So let's say by a dollar, 2,000 hours a year, that's $2,000 times a million. That's what, $2 billion? My math is right. $2 billion in improvement in aggregate demand minus the 34,000 people who lose their jobs at $7.25 or whatever they're making. That's a net gain for Pennsylvania's economy and for Pennsylvania's businesses.
I want to go to the phones. John is calling from Pittsburgh. He wants to talk about the elimination of cash assistance in Pennsylvania. You oppose that elimination, but ultimately it's now eliminated. John, yeah. Are you there?
Yeah. Hi, John.
John, do you have a question?
Yes, I'm here.
Let's hear your question, please, for Governor Wolf.
I wondered why the governor didn't inform his supporters via email and Twitter about this provision in the GOP budget to eliminate cash assistance for the neediest Pennsylvanians. They were using this for, like I was using it to help pay for my car insurance to enable me to find a job more easily. And I was planning to take out a life insurance policy so my family won't be stuck with paying final expenses. Could I please know why you didn't inform us of this and what you plan to do about it?
Thanks, John.
Yeah, I actually did try to inform everybody, and I strongly opposed getting rid of it. What happened was the Republicans in both the Senate and the House were set on eliminating it. They added it into a code that included some other things that I think are really important for people in need, like hospital assistance. And so it was something that was forced on me. They were really in lockstep in terms of wanting to get rid of it, and did my best to try to keep that from happening, but in the end it did. It's something that I think you point out some of the things that you used and wanted to use cash assistance for. I think it was a good program, and I'm sorry that it's no longer in place.
While we're talking about folks getting by, I also got a deluge of questions from people talking about property taxes. Mm-hmm. There's a push out there to have property taxes eliminated, supplement that with more state income taxes or sales taxes. So I heard from Susan Grove from Hanover, Henry Johnson from Jim Thorpe, Heather Mellinger from Lancaster, all on this topic. Also, Eleanor Procht is 72 and lives in Quakertown.
I know that there's people that are losing their homes because they can't afford the taxes. How can you lower taxes for senior citizens? What can you do? Or even do away with the current way of funding schools? Just give everybody actually a tax break, but especially seniors.
Yeah, I ran on property tax reform, real reform, in 2014. I even put it in my first budget. It's one of the things I think that just about everybody in Harrisburg supports property tax reform. No one agrees on how we're going to do it. No one has figured out a way, to your point, as to how we do it without raising somebody's tax somewhere. And that has kept us from actually getting to this. But it is a real problem because she's right. People, not just in Quakertown, but all across the Commonwealth are losing their homes because they're asked to pay a higher tax. Usually it's the school tax. I think that's two-thirds the mm-hmm. taxpayer bill in most municipalities. And it comes from the fact that Pennsylvania, the state, does not do its job in paying its fair share, I think, of school, the school investment. So if we shifted that to the point where Pennsylvania was, say, at a 50-50 state, where it was when I was a kid, that would create a lot of opportunities for people who are in the process of losing their homes. It would also, by the way, help a lot of poor communities who have to pay for their education for their kids out of the property taxes. And it turns out the poorest communities have the least amount of resources to devote to education.
So if you support this, you say there's a groundswell of support in the Capitol for it. You're in office 8 years and it doesn't get done. I know you're not there yet, but what does that say about state government?
Probably not much. I think you're right. I'm constantly talking to people. I said, let's talk about how we fix this. And I think, again, my impression is that there is broad support for doing something. That something has yet to be agreed upon. So it is frustrating. I admit. And if I got to 8 years and we haven't done something about that, I'm going to be the most frustrated person in Pennsylvania.
Anything popping on social media right now?
Yeah, I wanted to. We're getting quite a few questions about voting machines, the security of voting machines. I can read some specific questions, but I'll just point out that a lot of them are about the Express Vote XL machine that Philadelphia is using. Just generally, I know you say you're trying to make elections more secure in advance of 2020. Do you think we've done enough? Do you think our elections are secure heading into a really, really crucial campaign?
I think we are doing enough. I asked the General Assembly for $90 million, well, actually down payment $15 million or so that would be then coming in over the next number of years to get to 90. And they didn't want to do that. So I've found a way that I can, by executive action, come up with that $90 million to pay for new voting machines. And the way we've done it is to say, okay, we will help you pay for this. The feds have, I think, $14 million that they're putting in. The vendors will put things. But we vetted machines to make sure they have a paper trail, that there is some security as in terms of can they be hacked. As an MIT graduate, I know that there is probably no machine that cannot be hacked mm-hmm. by somebody somewhere. So what we need to make sure is that we have a paper trail, physical evidence that someone voted the way they did. These machines have all been vetted by our Department of State. The $90 million will be in place. There should be a board vote in the next week or two, and we can move forward. Is it going to be perfect? Absolutely not. But is it going to be better than what we have right now? Yes.
Laura, you have another question there?
I do. We've received a few questions on social asking about what your plans are for House Bill 1170. For people who don't know, this is a bill that passed both the PA's House and Senate that would impose what's called E-Verify, basically immigration status checking for people who work in the construction industry. It's now on your desk. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, I'm going to let it become law.
You are?
Yeah.
Tell me about your decision.
The decision is a tough one because it on the one hand, you have concerns, legitimate concerns, I think, about what this does to immigrants, people who come to the country looking for opportunity or asylum. On the other hand, it's an attempt to protect the legitimate rights of workers who want to make sure that their jobs aren't being taken away by someone who might be working for an unscrupulous contractor who would be paying them less than they deserve to get paid. So this is something that was passed overwhelmingly by both the House and the Senate in a bipartisan fashion. Yeah, and so I'm not going to sign it, but I will let it become law.
All right, in the last few minutes we have here, let's try to have a little bit of fun, Governor Wolf. Do you like fun?
Have you been having fun? I've been having fun.
Okay.
The whole time, yeah.
All right, so let's do a little fill in the blank.
Okay.
Okay. If I could live in one state other than Pennsylvania, it would be?
I was born in Pennsylvania. That's a dodge.
That's a dodge.
I think there's going to be a lot of dodges.
The last television show I binged watched was?
I think it was Chernobyl.
Oh, okay.
My go-to stadium food in Pittsburgh and Philly
hot dog.
It's always a hot dog for
yes.
you. Okay. All right. When you're driving your Jeep around the roads of your county, mm-hmm. give us an example of a song that you crank it up and roll the windows down.
I'm a Jackson Brown fan.
Okay.
So,
on board with that.
Call It Alone is my favorite song.
Okay. The biggest thing I learned from my time in the Peace Corps is?
Actually, this is more than just a one-word answer. The biggest thing I learned was that there's not anything that you can't do. That when you have to do something, you can do it.
The last book I read was?
I'm reading Testament right now by Margaret Atwood, and the last one I read was Handmaid's Tale, and before that was James Simpson called Permanent Revolution, The Illiberal Roots of the Liberal Movement.
When I see a spotted lantern fly, the first thing I do is?
Run.
You're supposed to smash
not
it.
Stop.
Right?
Yeah, you know, after I smash. Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, Governor Tom Wolf, thanks so much for making the time for us today in this live broadcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful being here.
Joined today by Laura Benshoff and Avi Wolfman-Arendt from the Keystone Crossroads team. Mm-hmm. This production was made by Keystone Crossroads, a partnership of WHYY in Philadelphia, WITF in Harrisburg, WESA in Pittsburgh, and WPSU in State College. Today's show was produced by Susan Greenbaum. Adam Staniszewski was our engineer. Emily Rizzo was our intern. Special thanks to all the stations for contributing.
Supporting WHYY, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. If you have been diagnosed with cancer, a second opinion may confirm your diagnosis and treatment plan, provide more details about the type and stage of your cancer, offer additional treatment options to consider, or recommend a different course of action altogether. MD Anderson at Cooper's Second Opinion Program can provide you with more information and help provide you with peace of mind. Appointments and information at 855-MDA-COOPER.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.